This is Penn Woods. This is September 1970. I'm interviewing in the office of Mr. John Mayo and John D. Mayo in the Mayo Building in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mr. Mayo came to Tulsa in 1903, and we will be talking about the early days of Tulsa. Mr. Mayo, to begin, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about where you were born and who your parents were.
I was born November the 15th, 1881, on my father's farm in north central Missouri, Randolph County, and our post office was Clifton Hill, Missouri, a small town 4 miles away.
Your parents?
My father. You want my father's? My father, John A. Mayo, and my mother, Emma Birch Mayo, lived on that farm until my mother passed away in 1909. After that time, he moved to the small town I mentioned above and became a resident of that little place. Now,
Mr. Mayo, you came to Oklahoma in 1903. What caused you to come to Oklahoma?
I, like all farm boys during those days, were very anxious to get off of the farm where we might have a better opportunity for income as we grew older and became responsible for our own living. So my brother and I, Mr. C.A. Mayo, who was at that time living in Dallas, Texas, connected with a real estate and banking firm, Murphy Bolands Incorporated. He, like myself, through correspondence from one to the other, were continually figuring out some place we might get together and open up a business that we might choose for our future growth in the business of making a living. In 1902, early parts of 1903, I was working part-time in a little general store in Clifton Hill. And in that store, they carried furniture to a certain extent, and I was assigned that part of the work for which I got a touch of the furniture business as being a possible future business for growth in a newly developed country such as we might locate in some place or other away from our part of the country. While that was happening to my life, my brother was happened to be living with a young man who was working for a furniture store in Dallas, and he visited with him a great deal at times, and got an idea that maybe the furniture business, inasmuch as I was already spending some time in it, might be the thing for us to get into. We, my brother at that time, met some traveling men from the south part of state down around Ada that were in Dallas, and in visiting about the new location for young fellows like ourselves, said, why don't you go to Oklahoma? Well, that sounded interesting to my brother, and we, of course, began to talk about that until later on. He came up to some small town around Davis, Oklahoma, to visit him for a weekend, and they talked him into coming up to Tulsa because it is on the Arkansas River, and it was a prospective town for future growth, as everything seemed to be working its way into the state and further west, not in as much as the two states, the Indian Territory was this part was a part of the territory in which Tulsa was in. He decided that if we would come, might come there and see what could be done. Well, we visited over by mail for a few months over that, and on August the 1st, 1903, he came up to Tulsa from Dallas and rented a small store, 25-foot store by 100 feet deep, from a native here, Mr. Steele, and we decided to that might be a good place to start in. So I agreed to that, and on the first day of October 1903, the same year, I came down here and met him. And from that date on, we mustered up a little money here and there and got into the furniture business, mostly on time, by a wholesale firm, Chase Furniture Company in Dallas, that took an interest in our desires and sold us what furniture we might need for 6 months at a time. And you might say they financed us for the first year on that basis, buying this, the needs that we thought we had for this part of the country. You know, I'm going too far with it.
I might ask, where is that location? Is that the same as your current store?
The location of that little store has now been demolished, and it is on the second 50 feet west side of Main Street between 2nd and 3rd coming south that we had this small store. And further than that, all I can say is we went to work. We didn't know much about the furniture business, only through hearsay, and took our chances on the growth of Tulsa based on the assumption that the natives here, the small board chamber of commerce men and so on, said that they had were going to have some gas and oil discoveries in this part of the country. Well, shortly after that, there was a small a pool of oil discovered over in West Tulsa, shallow wells. And in the meanwhile, there was a larger oil company, the name of Guffey and Gailey, who came out here from Pennsylvania, and they were very active in northern Oklahoma, Osage Nation principally, and all of that part of the territory, and became the big producers of, at that time, of all the natural gas that we had heard of up to that time. Soon after that, they did get gas, and we had gas in Tulsa. After about the third year, we were in business here, somewhere around 1905. We had natural gas piped into Tulsa, and from that time on, we learned that the possibilities were greater than they had expected. So about all I know about it from that time on, the discovery of oil and gas reached from the Osage Nation and West Tulsa, and then later on, and sometime around 1906 or 7, a man by the name Galbraith discovered a well, which was a real oil well, down in the Glen Pool section, which is southwest of here, about 5 or 6 miles. So that was the beginning of the oil business and the gas business for Tulsa, and from that time on, of course, we began to grow slowly but surely on what the future had to offer. As a result of some of those various discoveries, quite a few early day oil people from Pennsylvania came out here and lived in Tulsa and begun to explore the possibilities of the industry. Furthermore, at that time, the Frisco Railroad had just recently completed its entrance to Oklahoma City. Prior to the earlier days, the Frisco only came to Sepulpa. So that's about all I can say that would be of interest with the beginning of the growth of Tulsa and our growth with it in the furniture business. Naturally, we would enjoy the visits from the newcomers as they would come in slowly but surely from year to year, and our furniture business became quite a little business for us, to such extent that we had grown from the little store that in 1905 we rented a 50 by 130 foot building across the street known as the Sheldon Building and moved our little furniture store into that.
Thinking of the early furniture store, could you describe some of the early the furniture that you were selling, the types of furniture you were selling when you first came here?
Well, at that time we were selling for household use, principally iron beds made by a firm that was furnished by this jobbing interest, Chase Furniture Company from Dallas, known as the T.B. Laycock Company of Indianapolis, Indiana. And we got all of our beds for sleeping purposes there. And then as far as the bedding was concerned, we had nothing, but we never had anything to offer above a common ordinary mattress with a cotton top and excelsior filled body. That was the kind of a bed that mattress that we sold. And the Laycock people also furnished us our springs, coil springs, but the old fashioned coil spring that you set up the small iron bed and put the coil spring on next with bed slats in it, under it, and then put on this cheap mattress. And they were made naturally out of excelsior with a thin cotton top for comfort, only on one side, though. It wasn't reversible. And I know we sold them around $3.50 a piece, the mattresses, and we sold the beds all the way from $3 to $10 was about the tops for our beds. Springs also cost about $3 a spring. So that was a bed. As far as the furniture is concerned, our better furniture for the bedroom was what was called a folding bed. a bed built out of plain oak furniture with a mirror in the front, and cased inside was one of these cheap type beds that I'm telling you about, mattress and spring. And so that was let down at night for people to sleep in, that which they used in their guest bedroom, you might say, or their parlor, and they slept on that. And in the morning, they made it up and turned it, set it back up. So that was the bedroom. The chairs were very plain chairs, and most of the furniture that we bought from this firm, the only place we had any contact with or credit, came from High Point, North Carolina. And from there, we bought dining room furniture, sideboards, side tables, dining table, and chairs to go with it. That was our furnishings for the dining room. And I might say that entire equipment wouldn't run more than $50. All of it, chairs, tables, and other pieces of furniture that went in the room. On that floor, we were able to make a contact with some people who were handling, same as the Laycock people, they were agents for some what's called Axminster rugs, cheap Axminster rugs. Well, we bought a lot of those rugs for the dining rooms and for the living rooms and for the bedroom. And a 9x12 rug, and it was a very good grade. We sold for $12.50 to $15 a rug. Incidentally, I might say that I have had, but I've lost track of them right now, which I'm talking about 65 years ago now. Come in and tell me occasionally that they still have that 9x12 rug or two that they bought from me, and they think it's just as bright and pretty as it ever was, and they wouldn't give it up for anything, along with the furniture, the sideboards and the tables, still using them. So that's the way the whole thing worked out for us furniture-wise in that department. In the living room, we had a very comfortable Davenport, such as it was, and it made into a bed. It folded up as a full-length Davenport, and then it opened up into a full-size bed at night, and they used that in the living room to sleep on, along with the other pieces of furniture, such as chairs and little tables of one type or another, all cheap furniture, and all of it coming from this same manufacturing group over in the High Park, North Carolina, was our outlet for our furnishing of a home of that kind. As to the kitchens, we never handled anything in the stove or range fashion. And we stayed out of that because we didn't have money enough to get into it, and the kitchen range stoves at that time naturally had to burn wood. So we stayed out of that, and that's about the way we carried on for several years. And we grew with the growth of the community and the development of the surroundings, till we got dealing with other people like the Abernathy Furniture Company in Kansas City, who were another big jobbers that carried us from month to month for year in and year out, and along with William Volker, another great company up there that handled linoleums of all kinds, window shades, and curtains of one type or another, so that we could furnish a home in a pretty good way. And that's about all. I can't think of anything else that was more primitive than that beginning, but we made money on it. We worked hard. We worked 7 days a week and till midnight and lots of nights setting up that cheap furniture and getting it ready for sale. And as a result of that, and watching the ends and watching the growth of the town and visiting with all the newcomers and making friends. We were both very young men. I was about 22 years old after I landed here, and my brother was about 25. So we had lots of friends. Everybody was friendly. We had lots of visitors and lots of loafers that would come in, young men. The town was filling up with young prospective attorneys and young doctors, and they were all our friends, and they'd come in and trade with us. And then we got, our business got to a point where we sold on an installment plan to increase our volume. Well, we had to use a truck, a truck with horses to deliver this furniture. So finally, as we grew, the country had grown ahead of us, and we were on our way to greater things. So we operated in this 50-foot store across the street in the same block, only across the street, until 1909.
During the period, say from 1903 to about 1910, who were some of the personalities, some of the leaders in Tulsa during this early growth period?
Well, the merchants are the various types of merchandisers at that time was a firm called Williamson Brothers. They were next door to us. We had this little 25-foot store, and another young man from the south came here and opened up. He was a druggist. He had the other 25 feet. Then next, I can't remember his name right now. But anyway, he was a young man and active like we were, and he finally sold out and left. But Williams Brothers, George and Bill Williams, were the little general store on the corner. They had a 50 feet Williams, W-I-W-I-M, and so on. They were on the corner. And then shortly thereafter, the First National Bank moved from down between 1st and 2nd Street and a small bank that was opened up prior to that time, several years, by Mr. J. Forsyth, an early day cattleman and rancher that saw the need of a bank here, and they operated that bank until it changed hands and grew as we did, and other firms grew, and I don't remember the date now of the beginning of the old First National Bank, which was a five-story building on the corner right across the street of 2nd Street on the north, on the southeast corner there, right there where it is in, I don't know what's there. I believe that's torn away now. Now, as far as grocery people, there's a firm by the name of Trees Brothers that operated a grocery store right across the street from us. Then there was another firm called the Bean Vandiver Company, which was W.A. Vandiver of the Vandivers of this day now. Opa had a store on the east side of Main Street between 1st and 2nd. Now you understand at that time there were no sidewalks, only board sidewalks laid in front of each building as the elevation provided for them. So So when you got off the passenger train down at the Frisco and walked up to the corner of 4th and Main, it's like going up stair steps. You'd go 50 feet or 25 feet, and you'd go up a step. Then you'd go another 25 feet and up another step. And most of those boards were loose, too. And incidentally, while I'm speaking of the sidewalk feature of the fronts of all these stores, the weather had no pavement of any kind. The main street had hollowed out in between the east side from the west side to a very deep depth. So 2 or 3 feet deep, it had worked its way out. All horse-driven traffic, of course, handled that. And so that was about the view and about the conditions of Tulsa at that time. Just let's stop a minute, and I'll show you a picture.
Mr. Mayo, I just saw the picture you showed me of the Goodwill trip that you made in 1907, a group 1908. I wonder if you can tell us about it, where you went and what the purpose was.
Well, the purpose of this trip was motivated by the enthusiasm that our Chamber of Commerce built up among certain members of the Chamber, merchants like myself and many others. And so we finally made a contract with the Frisco Railroad to furnish us a train that would carry 120 people or more. And we also, the Secretary of our Chamber of Commerce had made all arrangements with the various cities we were to visit on this journey, which was an 18-day trip, telling the people in those eastern cities what we had to offer down here in Oklahoma in the way of a new way of life and the greatness of the oil and gas business that we were confronted with. There was no way to tell just how big it was going to be at that time, which has been proven, of course. But our stops were out of this. In Missouri, we stopped at Springfield and were entertained by the Chamber of Commerce there for an hour or two. And in St. Louis, and then over to Louisville, Kentucky, and then to Cincinnati, Ohio, and then to Toledo, Ohio. Then we went on to Philadelphia, and from Philadelphia we went to New York. New York, we went to Washington, D.C. From Washington, D.C., we went to Detroit and on around to Chicago and finally made our last stop at Kansas City at the end of our journey and had a great time and were treated marvelously well by all of the business people of the cities in which we visited. Only thing I can say about this that might be of interest is one would say, well, what did you do it for? Well, we had some people that responded to what we had in our little traveling show enough interest in this Southwest country that within a month's time there were somewhere between 25 and 50 people had moved here. As a matter of fact, to bear that out, I had made a very good friend and became a very important man here in Tulsa in his way, beat us home. With his family, came to Tulsa ahead of us on our trip. That as a result of the selling we gave him from our speeches and talks that he heard in the town in which he's living in. And that was in a town I can't think of now. That she's in Ohio, not Toledo. We stopped at some little town in Ohio.
Did this man remain here long?
I died right here. Man named Goodman.
Who?
Man named Goodman.
Goodman. Uh-huh.
Damn fine man. Yeah. So that it was a booster trip, and we. Of course, had just become a state, and we thought we were grown up, but we had a long ways to go, of course, and the only way we could gain would be by going out and inviting people to come down our way and see what we had to offer, and that was just a stepping stone to the many, many moves our Chamber of Commerce and other groups, civic clubs and so on, have made for the past 50 years towards the growth of Tulsa. They've all been imbibed with much enthusiasm and towards the cause, and have spread their feelings about the welfare and the greatness of this country to every friend that they could, and let that multiply that by the number of years that type of boosting has been going on. You can see how Tulsa has grown from a town of 1,600 people when I came here in 1903 to what the last report gives, 325,000 in the town proper.
I presume that was the first Goodwill trip.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were Goodwill trips a new thing across the nation at that time?
I never heard of one before.
Today it's an annual event of the Tulsa Chamber, isn't it?
Yeah, well, not necessarily. Some of these civic clubs make trips.
Yes.
Some of them do. It's a grand thing. Here's the idea. It's just, here's how valuable it is. I live out here in a block, and you live over in C block, and I don't try to get acquainted with you, or you get acquainted with me. First thing you know, and treat everybody else in those blocks the same way. If we have some sort of growing problems out there, if you don't make friends out of those people, how are you going to get in? How are you going to get the job done? So united we stand, and divided we, of course, stay apart, fall. That's about the best way I can tell you. And our Chamber of Commerce got sold on that idea that the only way to do is to go out here and sell what the oil people told us we had in the way of oil and gas possibilities in this state. And we knew that not only would something better than that come or as good later on, but we knew that it would bring a lot of people here that really would like to move away from the settled country in which they were in and get out into the wide open West. And that brings up a thought right now. We haven't very many spots left to move into for a relief from congestion and from tiresomeness of your surroundings and the retirement age of people that would like to get away. There's no new places for them to go and enjoy quietness and growth and freedom and interest in everybody being interested in the other man's problems. So where do we go? I can't think of a place unless it's New Mexico is a pretty fair spot. And I can't think of another place in the United States. We'll take for it to convince one of that thought. Look at the people that are trying to locate now in Alaska, in that terrible climatic country of Alaska, because it's a new frontier. So we've run out of frontiers, and Oklahoma can take care of another 2 or 3 million people more than it has here now, and everybody live and be prosperous and enjoy life and be a master of what they own if they want to come here. And not only that, industry is looking for the same kind of a country for their business, and as a result of it, if we handle our problems as we should, such as the development of this Arkansas Basin program, bringing industry to Oklahoma. We ought to gain another million people here in the next 10 or 15 years through industrial growth alone, and everybody have a home of his own and never had a home before in his life that's working for these industries. Of course, Oklahoma's got a big job ahead of it to make that interesting. They've got to build up their schools, their churches, and their way of life, and their roads, and everything of the kind to make it desirable, because these big companies don't just move for fun. They move to make a success of their program and to give the people that they employ, whether they be local or bring some of them with them, so that they are happy. An unhappy group of people, whether it be the Ford Motor Company or the General Motors, if they're all unhappy, you're in a bad way. So now that's about the way I see the possibilities of Oklahoma for a greater state in which to live in. We've got more water in this state by reason of the series of dams that the government has built here than any state in the Union, including the Great Lakes country. This country has got more sport area, more fishing ground, more hunting ground, and more wheat. We've got for produce, we've got wheat, we've got cattle, besides the oil, and many other things too numerous to mention, along with that recreational side that I mentioned here for weekends for people to go, and they can go in a day and night and be gone and never miss the time from where they live, take their families. And what else can you have? Have they got it in Missouri? No. Have they got it in Nebraska? No. Have they got it in Kansas? No. And name them and just name the states that haven't got what we've got in Oklahoma for recreational enjoyment. Just name it.
Let's go back.
All right.
Mr. Mayo, I'd like for you to discuss a little bit about the physical growth of Tulsa particularly. We might think of downtown Tulsa, including the streets as they were paved and grew up. The major buildings as they began to go up, the larger buildings, including your own buildings as well as the other buildings, the banks and so forth, the Civic Center, the past Civic Center, and as well as the current Civic Center. Just kind of recall as you can. The year is not as important as just basically what happened as these things began to grow up.
Well, the first street that was ever paved in Tulsa was First Street, paved from, Denver to the Midland Valley, what is now the Midland Valley Tracks. And it was paved, believe it or not, by brick pavement. That was later on, of course, taken up years afterwards and put down with a regular pavement. Beginning with, that was back in 1905 and 6 that they did that. Then from that time on, they started, the paving program begun to take action. I would say it started around 1906 or 7. Main Street, and then the different streets that they paved just like they do now, as they can get to them, and that's how far back. Now the first automobile that I ever saw in town was in 1907.
Who owned it?
Well, I can't think of his name right now. He was a lawyer, Maxwell Carr. First one that I ever saw here. See, that's trouble. I can't think of these things.
Right.
Well, anyway, the first building of any height was the old First National Bank building I'm talking about, five stories high. that was promoted by a group of the First National Bank, and that was the first five-story building. Then later on, R.T. Daniels, a man that was very well known here for many years, came here and he built that building on corner Third Main, Fourth and Main, next to our furniture store. Then he built the present Daniels building, and in the meanwhile, the National Bank of Tulsa, which was at that time called the Exchange National Bank, in place of National Bank of Tulsa, was built, the first unit of it, and then they rebuilt to it to where it stands now. And that was back, that was as early as 1900 and around 1910 that was done. Well, first one building after another, we had this building here, the first five floors and the first 50 feet, we only had 50 feet. We built a five-story building here in 1910. Then we purchased it 50 feet north of us here, where we're sitting now. This is the court in here. We purchased it, and we built a twin to it, tied it together, which
was
is just
an office building, Ben?
Yeah, always. But we had our furniture store below. We had three floors below in a furniture. Always, you know, because we never quit the furniture business. We got in the real estate business on the side, but we'd gotten up to where we were, in those days, pretty big boys, you know, in the furniture business. We sold a lot of merchandise, and we made a lot of money, and we didn't have anyone to bother us. Every dollar we took in, it was our dollar, and I didn't have the government to contend with at all. We had no taxes to speak of. We made I well remember one year here, we did $110,000 worth of gross business down, not in here, but down the street here, and cleared, I had cash clearance out of $90,000. Think that over. $110,000 volume, and we had $90,000 value. That's quite something. You see, we weren't giving anything away. And we weren't spending any. We were doing the work all ourselves, had no expense. Well, then came on, and getting back to the building thing, we had the palace building. Simon Jankowski built that building early. He built that two or three years after we built this building here. And then the First National Bank then moved. They got too big for their place, and they built a building which is vacant now on the corner of 4th and Main out here. Moved into that. Grant McCullough was the president and head of that. And then I told you about the National Bank of Tulsa. They built that first 10 or 15 stories there, and then built all around it, up and built a skyscraper.
About when was that built, if you remember?
Well, the newspapers can tell you every bit of this. They got the they built it sometime between 1930 and 1940. I forget when. But on and on, these buildings were built one after the other. Then Wade Phillips, of course, moved here from Ogmulgee. He was a big oil man, and he was in the sold his oil. Sold his companies out for big sums of money, and then he built the Phil Tower building over here, and then he built the building across the street where the Pan American is now, and then a lot of other built that fine home out here where the Philbrook is, and gave him $250,000 or $1 million to improve it, and he'd go out there and see what he did. He did it all. And he's one of the greatest benefactors this town ever had. There never's been a single man. I don't want to be quoted on that, because Bill Warren's doing a great thing, and Joe LaFortune's doing a great thing, and all that. But I mean, back in those days, he was the greatest benefactor we had. And Jim Chapman's been a terrific man. Great Scott, the money that he's given him. But you're talking about building. Now, I don't want to be quoted on anything that's going to get anybody saying, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm just telling you. Yeah. You asked me, and I'm telling you how this town was built. It is built by these different men. Well, we built this building. Then after we built this, a few years, we raised it on up 5 floors, the whole thing. Then we built in 1919, we bought this ground where the petroleum building is down here, and we built that building. Then in 1922, we bought from old man Bob Bynum, who was the man I was telling you about, that 150 by 140 feet down there, and built the Mayo Hotel. And we built that. We started it started excavating in August 1922 and opened it, ready for business, in February 1925. So the Mayo Hotel has been standing there since 1925. And I'm just saying this to you off the record. That's the best building in the state of Oklahoma. I'm just telling you that. That's the best building, because I know my brother and I built it. We didn't have any contractors. We had builders. We were the boss. If you can find a crack, it's 45 years old. That's over 45 years. It's about 45 years. 1925, 1970. Yeah, it's about 45 years. If you can find a crack in a ceiling or on a wall around there, I'll buy you a box of cigars. And you show me a building that's in Red Falls. Here, it's this building here. You're sitting in a room here. It's built in 1910. Well, no, it was built in 1915. This ray is top. And this building's full of rooms like this. Just look it around now. Then go over in these other, go over in these new buildings and look at them. They can't help it. They neither have the material that we had, nor they have the workmen. They didn't have the loyalty and the interest that we had in these people. And we were paying them $5 a day for 10 hours work, of course, to get this done. Now they're paying anywhere from $20 to $30 a day for these employees for 8 hours, and they're looking out the window and telling one of the funny stories half the time.
I suspect the only comparable building in Oklahoma City would be the Calkard building.
That was our number one building, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the Huckins Hotel. Yeah, I know it's
They had a hard time burning it down.
Yeah. Well, it was built right.
Yeah.
They built them right. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, they built them right. Mm-hmm. Well, now, I don't know. Is there anything else you want?
Well, you mentioned a few of the names, and thinking of the oil people and the others, you named some. Are there any other leaders in Tulsa in the field of business or education or religion or any other field that you feel ought to, not necessarily that you feel are the most important, because everybody's opinions of, you know, there'd be many differences.
I'd be afraid.
Other people you feel have made a contribution over the years to the growth of
I'd
culture.
Be afraid to touch on that, because I wouldn't know. There's many, many leaders here in that program. Mm-hmm. Industrially speaking, we have the leaders among the Chamber of Commerce group. Now, neither has Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. I was just talking to a man over there. They say when Gaylord passes out, the Chamber of Commerce over there, you know, has lost the greatest leader that they ever could hope to have. Whether they agreed with him on everything or not, we fought him with the newspaper if he didn't like it, but he always supported it. He's a great man. I know him quite well. But we haven't got them. We haven't got the... I'm just talking this. You haven't got the men like my brother and myself were in business now, coming on, that paid their way, borrowed their money, paid the debts, didn't ask anybody for credit to go on their note. You haven't got that class of people today to build a town. If they want to build a building, today it's promoted. A promoter comes in here and he gets an architect and he tells them how much, here's the building that you want, and here's what it'll cost. The government is backing it up now, and the insurance companies, he takes these figures to them and says, and he borrows 100% or more on the estimate. And a lot of these deals are never going to work out.
You had mentioned that in the early period that seeing a horse, or was a horse or mule, I don't remember which, that was up to his rump in mud.
A horse. These.
Can you describe, we'll put this on now, can you describe that situation about when it was and what happened?
Well, Main Street was, as I had said before, was had washed out to where it is almost a dry stream. It is so deep, as against the sidewalks on each side of the street, from the Frisco tracks all the way up to 4th Street, which is a south end of town, you might say at that time. So in order to build it up and getting ready for a paving contract, someone took a contract and filled all that street with dirt, good rich dirt. It took a lot of it, filled it from off of those two blocks, or three blocks almost, up to the top. And in some places there, that fill was as much as 5 feet deep to level it off, make it a level with the building's surface, you know. During heavy rainstorms, the cab drivers had the horrors of their life to get around. And we had one very long, rainy spring, I recall, and there was no sight at all to see horses drawing these cabs in mud up to their bellies and unable to move any further, and had to be gotten the harness taken off of them and taking them loose from the cab, and get a rope and somebody help on the outside to pull that horse out with a team of horses on the side. Put a rope around his belly and around him, and the team pull him out of that mud hole. It wasn't more than 10 feet wide, but nevertheless, it had to be done. That's the only way you could get him out. That didn't happen too often, but it happened once. Shortly after that great fill I'm talking about was made to level Main Street up, we had that rainy spring, and that was the result of it.
What would you say in Tulsa over the years, thinking particularly back in the early years, were the most either outstanding or maybe traumatic events? In other words, a major fire or a major storm or something like that.
Well, the biggest fire that we ever had in Tulsa, the most damaging fire we ever had in Tulsa, was right here, mail building. All this top, all this hall burned up. We had to tear the concrete down, all down to the floor. Burned up all this block here, and we caught over here in Kelmer's decorating store. He had a painter over the C.D. Kelmer paint shop, and he had his basement filled with barrels of oil. And the next to it, that's this whole block almost down to where the corner is. And then next to it, that building belonged to Mr. C.P. Alexander, the man who owns this building across the street over here. That time he was alive and here. That it caught, and when the fire, it caught somewhere in this paint shop about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. No one around here at all. And this top of this building was in the casings, you know, where cement poured there, had lumber all around it, you know. So when that fire caught, got into that basement, the blaze went 100 feet above the top of this building.
When was that?
In 1916 or 17. Burned all night. Fought it all from around 7 o'clock in the evening when they discovered it until they're still fighting it at noon. Got it out about daylight the next morning. My brother and I went down in the basement of this building here where we had furniture down there. We had a big basement there. And to look around and see the furniture like this desk sitting here. And then, so we were wading in our water right up to here, up to our hips. That's how much water had been poured on and run into there.
Any storms that were a particular note over the years?
No, we've never. I don't know of any great disaster we've ever had here. One of much that has caused very much many problems to the community. I don't know a thing that's outstandingly bad.
What about events, newsworthy events that happened in Tulsa that you feel, particularly those you may have either witnessed or been a part of or have firsthand knowledge of?
Well, I don't know. I guess as far as we want to get materialistic like I am, I think the greatest event that we ever had here from a growing angle was the day we celebrated they turned the water into Tulsa from Spavinaw.
When was that? Do you recall?
1925.
1925. Can you describe the? Was there a celebration or?
Yes, we had a short. Some people come here from the east and made some talks from St. Louis and so on. Just dedicated. It was to us. We had no water. This Arkansas River water was not fit to use. You know, people were buying bottled water, and we're growing and growing and buying bottled water. And you couldn't take a bath in a tub. When you got out of it, there'd be enough sand in the bottom of the tub to fill that drawer, and so on. So the Mail Hotel never had a gallon of anything except Spavinaw water into it. We built it that way. We moved. We were slow. We built our hotel, started in 22, and opened it in 25. We didn't move any faster than the water line moved from Spavinaw. So when we opened this hotel, we opened with Spavinaw water. So it was naturally a great event, for not only because of the personal feeling about it, but because of the fact it did so much good to so many people. Now, as far as other incidents are concerned, I wouldn't know. We've had a lot of little things here, just like Oklahoma City. I wouldn't know what to say that was of unusual importance. It's been hard to say. I don't know what you're driving at.
Well, I think what I'm driving at is what you're telling me, which is great. Can you tell about the opening? Did you have an opening ceremony for the Mayo Hotel?
Oh, sure.
Tell about it.
Well, we just had a grand opening. We threw the entire building open so the people could march through from top to bottom and from top floors all the way up and down, look it over. And we had no other celebration than that, only just a welcome to the public to come and see what we had to offer. And so we were owed a lot of money when we opened the doors, and we were anxious to get busy more than anything else. You take these big companies, you know, now they have some, they'll spend $50,000 saying grace over something that they're spending the stockholders' money. We were spending our own money, and we gave everybody a warm welcome and everything the kind, and then we got busy and said we're in here for business. Had to. So we owed $1.5 million. We had to work it out.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayo. We have just concluded an interview with Mr. John D. Mayo of Tulsa, Oklahoma. This is September 1970, and we're in Mr. Mayo's office in the Mayo building.